How can I help? How can I be useful in ending needless suffering? Do not be afraid of work that has no end.
We have to organize a social movement.
We have an opportunity to lead by example versus just talking, hot air.
I think the more people in this fight, the more we grow. Eventually, you could change. You know, the people are the ones that can make the change.
Have you ever trusted somebody with your life? And I mean, really put your life in their hands. Imagine what that takes. Imagine the level of trust involved with that. Imagine being asked to go to a country where you don't speak the language, where you don't understand the minute cultural differences and how the wrong piece of clothing could expose you to grave danger and risk, the wrong dialect, the wrong actions, the wrong vehicle, the wrong license plate, the wrong tags on your vehicle could all lead to you being detained and potentially killed. How much would you have to trust somebody to let them help you completely, to take your hands off the wheel and let them drive in an environment like that? It's hard to describe. And my guest today is Chad Robichaud. Chad is a former Recon Marine, and he's a DoD contractor, or was a DoD contractor. He completed 8 combat deployments to Afghanistan during his time in service and as a contractor. But more importantly, Chad is the co-founder of Save Our Allies, an organization that definitely came to the forefront during the withdrawal from Afghanistan. He's also the author of a book, Saving Aziz. Aziz was Chad's interpreter when he was overseas. And the situation that I described of trust, the taking the hands off the wheel and putting your life in somebody's hands, is essentially the story of Aziz and his working relationship with Chad. And then what happened to Aziz after Chad left that country and the struggles that Chad personally went through to ensure that Aziz was able to leave that country before the Taliban was able to capture him and his family. Save Our Allies is a nonprofit organization established to help American citizens, refugees, and those who helped Americans during the war on terror in Afghanistan. During a 10-day time period, Save Our Allies and their team of 12 was able to rescue 12,000 people from Afghanistan. Unfortunately, many of others were left behind, and they are still facing incredibly dangerous conditions. According to the Nonprofit Association of Wartime Allies, the AWA, 78,000 allies were left behind during the United States withdrawal from the country. A year after the withdrawal, special immigrant visa, SIV, applicants trying to come to the U.S. who had assisted during the war effort were surveyed by the AWA. 29% said they had been imprisoned by the Taliban at some point. 51% of them reported that they had been questioned or detained by the Taliban. 92% have lost their jobs since the U.S. evacuation. 34.5% of the women reported that they or a female member of their family have been sexually propositioned by members of the Taliban. My guest today is trying to do something about that. So we both joined pre-9/11. Talk to me about your experience post-9/11 and those 8 deployments that you did to Afghanistan.
Yeah, so originally I was going to go, I was gearing up on a deployment to Iraq when I had the opportunity to go. So I'm getting ready to go to Iraq, and I had the opportunity. One of my former buddies from CAG, Delta Force, approached me and said, hey, there's this opportunity to try out for a JSOC task force. I didn't really even know what an AFO was at the time, but they were standing up an AFO cell, Advanced Force Operations cell, to do for clandestine logistics for, you know, NSW's premier unit. And they were letting Marines try out. They were having some guys from CAG try out. And so I had the opportunity to try out for it. I tried out and was selected and went through about 8 months of training to do that job. And I got put on this task force to do all the clandestine logistics and advanced forward operations work to put our soldiers on target to capture or kill bad guys like you, to put you guys on target and make sure that not only did you get on target with all the logistical resources you needed, but all the contingencies were in place to get off a target if anything went wrong, how to move a team or move injured, you know, team guys out of there, or all the clandestine level QRFs type efforts as well. So in doing that, you work what's called a singleton, in a singleton capacity. So you either work with one other guy. There was a team guy that I worked with a lot named Dave Lamone. And then there was, but most of the time I worked independently with it, with a local national. And so my local national I worked with was Aziz. Aziz was had formerly worked with Third Special Forces Group and was an anti-terrorism task force guy. And Aziz was like, man, highly vetted, highly trained to be able to work with me. And I mean, polygraphed, like everything. It was very and he ended up being my teammate, and we just clicked. And for continuity purposes, all eight of my deployments were with Aziz. So I think most interpreters, you know, work with you have an interpreter for your whole unit, and then you maybe get a new interpreter every time you do a different deployment. It's usually a different mission. I had the same mission. It was, I say eight deployments a lot, but it was really just one continuous operation that I was part of. And Aziz was my interpreter all the way through that. And we became super close and had done, you know, hundreds of, well, I say hundreds, probably well over 100 of those operations of going ahead and setting up our assaulters to get them on target, and built a really robust clandestine infrastructure to be able to, you know, operate in very non-permissive areas. And so that was the extent, that was my type of deployments. You know, I trained, you know, all those years to be on a force recon team. And then now I'm in a enabler capacity, doing clandestine logistics. And I never even knew about that job, but when I did it, I absolutely loved it. There's probably lots of jobs you could do in combat. There's probably nothing more fitting for me. Looking back and doing that job, I loved it. It was very suited for me.
If you could, or what would be the best way for you to explain the relationship that you had with him? So I worked with interpreters, but like you mentioned, it was on a rotational cycle. And even in that rotational cycle, we would develop, there's a level of rapport and trust and respect. And they were doing things that if somebody would have asked me to do it, like, hey, go up to this door unarmed and knock on it in the middle of the night. And oh, by the way, we're relatively certain that the people on the other side of this door are not going to be very happy to see us when you open it. And they're like, oh yeah, no problem. And I'm like, oh yeah. My God, you are out of your mind. But that was, and we would have one or two interpreters for a large, you know, deployment for an entire task unit. The relationship that you had with Aziz is at a level that I think most people would struggle to understand. So that the trust, just if you could explain what it started out as and what it became, and just the type of things that you guys would do together.
Yeah. So, I mean, and by the way, we've seen it increase over time, and what really built that trust was watching him make personal sacrifices along the way with his personal safety, with his family, and the risks he was willing to take for America. And for freedom for his country. And so, you know, when we first started, we were in a, you know, we'd be like, he'd be strictly interpreting for me and one of the team guys I was with. But then as he proved himself, he pretty much became a team person. That way, like what you're saying, you're in two, right? Two is one is none. Like you have to have a second person, even in Marine Recon, like we have small 6-man teams, but if you stop at an ORP, objective rally point, and break away to do a recon and surveillance for the operation, you're going to go in two guys. And you would never just do it with an interpreter. And so early on, he was the third wheel. He was an interpreter. But as he got more and more vetted, made some decisions, did some things, just the mission creep and the need to be everywhere at once, and the limited resources of people that we had, because it's not a popular job. There's not a lot of guys that want to do it, particularly team guys. Team guys like, no, I want to be, you know, coming through the door and shooting people in the face. And booms, so it's not a lot of guys. What's that?
Booms and bangs. That's what.
Yeah, yeah. So it's not a lot of guys that want to do it. So it's like always. So we were always. And so Aziz started, like, I was like, hey, I'm going out to Jalalabad, and Aziz would be the guy to go with me. And so, like, if we were going to put our soldiers on target to capture or kill a bad guy, we have to go ahead of them. And we have spent, you know, weeks, months, years building infrastructure, meaning businesses, and having what's called place access and placement, which we're building a reason to be there, because we're in non-permissive areas, meaning that's not where traditional military is going to be. So we have to be there and build this, like, this access and placement to make, when we put this clandestine operation and the assaulters on target, nothing seems out of place. So we go there ahead of them. We're looking at all the routes, validating the routes. If we're going to bring vehicles in, now we're going to buy local national vehicles. By the way, Aziz, can you buy 10 Hilux pickup trucks and register them in your cousin's name? And then on those pickup trucks, they need to have all the right license plates, because every province has a different license plate. They need to have the right permits. Who's going to be at these checkpoints? What are the police there? What do we need to know about them to be able to, when we go on target, that way there's no hiccups. And what do we have to have over them, or what do we have to provide for them to make sure that when we roll on target? So all these things have to be in place. And then all the contingencies, like we're going to have safe houses in place, staged vehicles. What goes into safe houses? They need to be like hard drums to be able to fight from. They need to be local national weapons and ammo, like AK-47s and PKMs and hand grenades and all the ammo that would go there. They need to have communications set up in place. We need water, local national clothes, money, food, supplies, blood. Everybody in the team that's going to be there, what blood types are they? We need to have blood on station there, right? Who's a doctor that we could have on standby locally that doesn't even know that they're going to be used, but we need to make sure they're there on time. So all that stuff has to be in place before you put assaulters on target in very non-permissive areas, because these are areas that, you know, aren't going to have a quick QRF or any other kind of military resources there. And so we'd spend, you know, weeks and months setting that up. And you're living in these areas. And you got to think about what's happening. Like, we're living in these areas, and these are areas, the reason you're going there is because the Taliban's there. And there's no other U.S. military presence there. So that's the areas we're living in, setting all this up. And so
I hope it comes across to the watcher or listener too, all of those things that you described, and I'd be curious to hear your thoughts on this, but I feel like it would be impossible to do all of those things absent people like Aziz.
No, you can't. Impossible.
It takes one mistake, like you said, in the vehicle registration, and you're blown, and people know that you're not supposed to be in there, or the wrong type of clothing. Anything along that chain, the level of the depth of knowledge that those local nationals bring, what we used to do is just utterly impossible without their support.
Yeah, I could have a pool. I could have a pakul on, which is a, you know, tribal headwear in one province, and I drive like 5 miles, and where that made me acceptable in that area, now I'm going to be rolled up for wearing that piece of headgear. It's like, okay, take that hat off now. Okay, I have my suit, a little picture of my suit with some little dangly tassels hanging on my rearview mirror. That's really good in this area. Take that off now, because now it's going to get us in trouble for having Masood's picture on. And so everything like that is like, and you know, you can't. I always say, like, Aziz saved my life on these three specific occasions, but he probably saved my life every single day. Like, don't walk there, don't eat that, don't talk to the person. If you actually talk right now, they're going to kill us. Like, so be quiet. And I mean, so like having someone like that was just essential. And, you know, I mean, you spend 10 hours in a car ride with someone, you, at the end of it, you either love them or hate them. Like, there's plenty of long car rides with Aziz and just living together and talking about life. I mean, when you're not just talking about work in those environments, you're talking about life. I'm talking about my family. I'm talking about his family. He's talking about his daughters when they grow up, and he don't want them to be in a country where they're going to be forced to be married and be sexually enslaved. He don't want his sons to have to be forced to be in the Taliban. So he's talking about ideas of freedom and democracy in a way that I'd never even heard Americans speak about it before. And he gets it. He never really experienced it. So, like, I just had a tremendous amount of respect for him, willing to be, I mean, he was fighting for America, but for him, he wanted a free Afghanistan. He wanted his future children to be in a free Afghanistan. He was fighting for his country. And, you know, so I appreciate he was supporting us, but I really even more respected what he was willing to fight for in his country and the things that he was willing to sacrifice and risk. I mean, that he just got recognized by Congress. We put him in for this award where he was recognized by Congress. I think he's the first Afghan ever to be recognized that way, for leading an operation that, you know, I was tasked with, and I didn't know how to go get these four team guys that were caught in this Taliban village, and they were in one of our vehicles. And if they would have sent a traditional QRF in, I mean, the guys would probably got out, but a lot of people would have been killed, civilians. I mean, this Taliban invested village, maybe some U.S. personnel would have been injured. We know how those QRFs go, especially when you're going into a hot place like that. And the whole mission would have been compromised. But Aziz came up with a really quick, hasty, clandestine plan. And who's like, and he was like, not like, hey, here's a plan, send someone else to do it. He's like, and I'm going to drive us there. And we got in a car and drove all night and went to got those, you know, scooped the four team guys up and got the equipment, all the essential equipment out. And the operation wasn't compromised. And later on, well, everything was reconvened. And later on, they went back and got the bad guy. And so, you know, he did that stuff all the time.
Yeah, it's unbelievable the risk that the host nation or local nationals take. Like you said, their families still live there, and they will 100% be targeted by people who can't necessarily get directly to that individual working with American forces.
Yeah, I mean, I chose to do that, but my wife and kids are back here safe, and, you know, it's a big difference.
How was it for you when you started hearing about and then watching the withdrawal for Afghanistan?
Man, it was, I mean, I remember even like in January, and President Biden was saying he was going to do a full and complete withdrawal. I was mortified because I knew what would happen. I knew that it would be very difficult to get Americans out, and I knew that we're not going to get our allies out. I mean, it's very clear because you can look at the SIV process, the special immigrant visa process, and see, you know, since 2009, that we made this promise in 2009 that we'd give a 6-month process if they fulfilled their contract with us. Just a handful of people would have ever actually happened for. Even Aziz had been in that process for 6 years after doing 15 years at top tier special operations. You know, it was just, so I'm like, man, we're going to leave our allies behind. And strategically, I felt like it was a mistake for the United States from a national security level. I mean, Bagram Air Force Base is the most strategic place in the globe between Iraq, Iran, Russia, and China. And the only people that benefit from our absence there would be our enemies. And I'm not a long-term war guy, but I do believe in contingent forces around the world. We had 2,500 troops there. So I think the American people were lied to say that we were in this endless war, this 20-year war. We were in a support and advisor role that Afghan National Army and the international community were all participating at Bagram Air Force Base, doing that successfully. And we were keeping the Taliban at bay in the mountains of Afghanistan where they belong. So we should not have done a full withdrawal. We should have just turned it over, kind of announced the victory, handed it over to the international community, and continued to participate. You know, in truth, we have contingents like that all over the world. We have 4,000 troops right now in Djibouti, Africa. I can name 10 places like that. Yeah. We still have 50,000 troops in Japan and 35,000 in Germany and South Korea. We have 35,000, you know, since World War II and the Korean War. So these contingent forces don't keep us in sustained wars. They prevent us from being in wars and it brings stability in those regions. So for me to pull us out was very political. It benefited our enemies like China and Iran and Pakistan ISI, which, by the way, Pakistan is not an ally, although they claim to be, and we claim for them to be. They're the enemy of freedom in America. And so, yeah, so I thought that in itself, like, really disturbed me. But then when I looked at people like Aziz, I was really burdened. And in April, Bashir, the guy who ratted us out to the Taliban, our command had caught him and put him in Bagram jail. I mean, this guy had like where I slept, what times I took, like he had all my routes and times and how I deviated my routes and times, where my safe was in my houses. Like, I mean, this guy had everything when the command caught him. And then they put him in Bagram jail. Then he went to Policharki jail, and then he got moved to Saudi Arabia. And then President Obama did a mass release, and he was released in that mass release. And he went back to the Taliban and eventually became a Taliban leader. So in April of 2021, he started looking for Aziz and some of the other teammates we had. So Aziz ended up being on a run, and I was helping him move house to house. And we had a plan to go get him early on, but the evacuation started to, the withdrawal started to progress really fast. And the way the Taliban was coming in through Pakistan, you know, coming from Pakistan, and, you know, we watched them cross the border, 75,000 of them, and they took province by province. And that Doha agreement that they agreed with, which, by the way, the Doha agreement is an agreement between the United States and the Taliban saying that they will not conduct any terrorist activity, which, by the way, they are terrorists. So, you know, right away as they're coming in, they grab 25 of our the commandos and execute them in the street, which violated the Doha agreement, and nothing happened to them. So that just showed that we were not going to hold them accountable to that agreement. And things just went really quickly. And I knew that we would have to go get Aziz ourselves.
Yeah. Where did it come from? What was the tipping point for you where you realized you had to get involved and help with the withdrawal? Because you ended up being one of the people who started Save Our Allies and got deeply involved for, you know, what was it? Just about 2 weeks in the withdrawal process before it kind of closed down.
Yeah, it was 10 days of we were there 10 days, but yeah, about 2 weeks before the withdrawal process. But for me, it was I was working the diplomatic angles. like through the State Department, through Congress. I know a lot of people in Congress. And so when I really realized that I wouldn't be able to, that I had to take personal action, I was working with Congresswoman Vicki Hartzler. And she, like, when she heard Aziza's story, and she's a great friend, she'd done a lot of stuff with me with Mighty Oaks Foundation, my foundation for veterans. And she, when we heard Aziza's story, she's like, he has to be here. We have to get him out. And she was like so convicted by that. And then she started pulling all the strings that she knows as a U.S. Congresswoman. And she's like, this isn't going to happen. She was trying. And I had other people trying. And when I realized that, you know, someone was intentionally closing the door on wartime allies like Aziz, intentionally not allowing them to come over, they were like, hey, they just need to go to the embassy. Well, the embassy is closed because of COVID. And they closed it because of COVID during the withdrawal, by the way. They closed the embassy because of COVID. And then when you watch them leave Bagram Air Force Base without notifying our allies or Americans, I mean, it was very clear at that time that this was going to collapse and be a catastrophe. And it was going to be, it was going to happen quickly. I mean, they made several mistakes that I watched happen that made me realize we had to act. One was they gave the NEO operation, a non-combatant evacuation operation. I say they, meaning the White House, gave that operation, the NEO operation, from the DOD, Department of Defense, and gave it to the State Department, which is not their job. The State Department doesn't do military action. They're there for diplomacy, and the military is there for military force, right? So that's what the NEO operation going to them is like, you're asking for failure. I mean, it's like asking the baggage handler, because he works in a plane, to fly the aircraft. It's going to crash. And they treated the how many cars out of airport and used the military to treat it like an embassy. And so their strategy was like, hey, we're going to protect this airport while we do evacuations, but everyone has to get here. And if you could get onto the airport, then we could evacuate you. But no one in the United States military is going to go out like they normally in a NEO operation. And so that set it up a really catastrophic scenario where we just saw mass chaos and panic of people flooding at the airport. Americans, that one time the White House said there's 16,000 Americans out there, and we got 6,000 out. And now then they said, they had 100 left. Terrible math. I'm not even good at math, but nothing added up. And then they're telling people,
call that math. I think that's just a number that they, I don't know where they actually produce that number from. It's not mathematically based, I could tell you that much.
No, it's just not true. And they're telling Americans, they're like, hey, if you want to leave, and they're telling people just don't want to leave. If they want to leave, all they got to go to this airport. Well, you have to look at what happened there. Like you have probably 100,000 people swarming on the airport. People are being trampled to death. The United States military, mainly the Marine Corps, is the perimeter of the airport. Then the next perimeter is the 00 units. It's the last Afghans that are trying to do their job till the end. They're like basically forfeiting their lives to do their job till the end. And then the outer perimeter was given to the Taliban, won by organically, they can take the outer perimeter, but even so, not just organically, the State Department gave it to them and told them to control the outer perimeter. And so that's the scenario that they're having. So they're telling Americans that they have to go to the airport. Well, they have to pass Taliban perimeter. So if you could picture yourself as like a 20-year-old humanitarian worker, some girl out of wherever hometown America, coming, going there, wanting to teach English at a school or provide medical aid to women or do Christian ministry work, whatever she is, but she has her blue passport. She has to go to show it to a Taliban fighter with an AK-47 who's murdering people in the street, by the way, because they were cutting people's body parts off in the street. That's just not going to happen. So for the White House to say to the Americans, hey, you mustn't want to leave unless you're going to willing to go through this checkpoint in front of this Taliban. And then if you could get past, now you got to make it through a crowd of 100,000 people. And the level of chaos was like, people were literally being stomped and trampled to death in the mud. The Taliban was shooting for crowd control. People were, taking their babies, infant babies, and putting them on top. They were kissing them goodbye because they'd rather give them a chance to get to freedom than let them become like the little girls become sex slave forever, or the boys be going to madrasas and become terrorists. They kiss these babies goodbye, put them on the top of the crowd surf them to the wall and throw them over the wall. And not realizing on the other side of the wall was like 6 feet high of Constantino wire and 20 feet deep of Constantino wire. My buddy Joe Robert counted six babies in that wire that bled to death. I mean, that's the level of chaos that you're asking, Americans to go through. And get. So it was completely, a lie to the American public to say that, hey, if they're not showing up to evacuate, then they don't want to leave. They were not given any forewarning. They were told that they had time. you know, the military vacated Bagram Air Force Base before they vacated their equipment and before they vacated allies, but most importantly, before they vacated Americans. And that was, I don't believe that was accidental. A lot of people use the word botched or withdrawal. I don't think it was botched at all. That was very deliberate. These people may have made this tragedy, but they're not dumb. They knew this would, things would happen that way. And, you know, when they had the opportunity to reopen Bagram Air Force Base, they didn't. There's some things that are redacted in my book that I can't say here, but I could tell you that they had the opportunity to retake Bagram Air Force Base. And Bagram Air Force Base would have been the primary evacuation point, not Hamid Karzai International Airport. Hamid Karzai Airport is a public civilian airport. Bagram Air Force Base is a bigger airfield, already has our C-17s there, and it's fortified. Fortified to the point that we, you know, we kept U.S. troops there for 20 years. It's been established for 20 years. Why would we not make that our evacuation point? And, you know, it's terrible. So while I'm watching this happen, I'm like, man, we're going to have to go in and get Aziz, his wife and six kids. And we took action, and I called a few special operations veterans who had a lot of experience, but mostly had some maturity, not looking to go out and fight with the Taliban, and had that kind of itch out of their system, and asked if they go help get Aziz, his wife and six kids. And one of those people was Tim Kennedy. And then I was very good friends with Sarah Berardo, who knows a lot of people in DC. And then we had a lot of Green Berets and SEAL, War Street Gun guys, and some guys at Ground Branch, which is the our intelligence agency's paramilitary unit. And so we put together a really good team of some really sharp guys who knew a lot. And as we're putting the operation together, go get Aziz, one of the guys brought up, hey, there was just this group of 3,500 orphans and all their caretakers just left them. Like, let's go get them too. And that was kind of a moment we paused and said, man, we have this willingness. We have all these amazing people here, the resources. Let's go get as many Americans, interpreters, their families, women, children, Christians that be persecuted. We're all, I think everyone there is pretty strong people of faith. And there's a Bible verse, Isaiah 6:8, you know, hear my, send me. And we called it Task Force 6-8 out of that. And we were funding it originally out of my foundation, Mighty Oaks Foundation, but it's not what we do. So we stood up. That's where we stood up to Save Our Allies effort, to kind of be clean on the books of what we do as an organization. But it took a little while to actually stand up the 501c3. So we're running as a Save Our Allies coalition under the Mighty Oaks Foundation in partnership with the Independence Fund. That's how we started it. And man, we just went in and we get a lot of credit for how the thing unfolded. But the truth is, I'm a pretty strong person of faith. I believe this was like an actual divine miracle, because the things that happen, man, it was like any one of the things didn't happen the sequence it did, it wouldn't have happened. And honestly, like, I'm not smart enough or capable enough as a leader, like, to pull off what actually happened, because, you know, everybody knows this. I think most people probably know the story. We didn't just get Aziz's family, but we got 17,000 people out. What happened in between that decision to go get Aziz and getting 17,000 people out was just a miraculous series of events. The first being Sarah Berardo calling the Joint Chiefs and asking for permission for us to go as civilians under the DOD controlled airport to go evacuate civilians, which they wouldn't even allow in the military to do. For them to give us permission to do that is like either a miracle in itself, or Sarah had some pictures of somebody that
or both.
Whatever, or a little bit of both. We got permission to do that. And then we had the ability to move people who are visa applicants. Like, not, these aren't people that have visas. These are like SIV applicants, P1, P2 visas, or people that were like legitimate asylum seekers. We had to vet them, make sure they were legitimate. We had a bona fides process on the ground of grabbing them, but then we had to be able to move them without visas to another country. And that's human trafficking, right? You have to have a place to legally bring them. I'm not the State Department. I can't bring them to the state. So I have to have a place to bring them. And we called the Royal Family of the United Arab Emirates. We had some contacts there, and they heard our case. And at the end of about an hour long call, they said they'd roll out the red carpet, and they did, like, medical care, food, housing. Gave us the permission to do that. And they said, we'll give you a C-17 plane and pilots. And if you fill that up, we'll give you another one. And then I had a radio show host, Glenn Beck, which many people probably know who Glenn Beck is. He called me and said, Chad, I went on the radio to raise a few $1,000, and I raised $21 million in 3 days. Like, what do I do with it? And I'm like, I need you to start chartering planes. And he put a guy named Rudy Atala from Mercury One Ministries together with us and started chartering planes for us. And so we went there, and Sarah led operation in Washington, D.C. I led the JOC in Abu Dhabi. We had a ground team in H. Kaya, And we spent 10 days on the ground. We had no idea how much time we had, but in 10 days, we did not stop. Cause if you stop in something like that, when it's moving, if you stop and sleep for 5 minutes, like you're literally trading for someone's life. Sea Spray, my buddy Sea Spray lost 37 pounds in that 10 days. And we ended up pushing till the Abbey Gate blew up and 13 of our service members were killed. And at that time, the military welded the gate shut. They were forced to leave after that. And I remember we didn't even know how many people we had got out of that time. It ended up being about 12,000. But as the military is leaving, we just met and reconvened and we're like, what are we going to do? Like the military has to leave, but we don't have to. We knew there were thousands of Americans there. Again, the news was saying, in the White House saying there's 100. The truth is there were thousands of Americans there. We know it. We're hearing that now in the hearings, but to me, it didn't matter if there was 100. If there was one, that's too many, right? I mean, you know where you come from, like it's like scorched earth to get an American, even like traitor, yeah, like Bo Burdo, like, hey, we're going to lose people. Yeah, he's an American. Let's go get him. That's
what do you estimate as far as how many people are left behind?
I don't think we will ever know. I know for, because we don't have the number on Americans because they don't have to, Americans don't have to register when they travel abroad. The State Department has a process, but you have to initiate that process on your own. Most Americans, 90% of Americans don't. So we don't know how many Americans are there. I would guess that when we left, there were over 1,000 Americans there. And that's the number that's been coming up in the hearings, that there were over 1,000 Americans there. And there's been none that have been safely evacuated since. So I would think there's over 1,000 Americans still in Afghanistan, either in captivity, and we'll never know because the Taliban obviously won't reveal that, in captivity by the Taliban or by, you know, some of our other enemies around the world that are in. I mean, China runs Bagram Air Force Base now. Iran's there. Pakistan ISI is running pretty much everything there. So we don't know. We do know that we have 75,000 of our wartime allies that have been left behind. They are identified. The State Department has given lists of them to the Taliban. Because they're saying, hey, let's give you a list of who should be able to come out, right? Basically identifying who they are. And they're being rallied up every day since August of 2021, being rallied up, stuffed in the back trunks of cars, driven off, never to be seen again. And we know that. And the State Department is moving out. You got to think with the allies and their families that would qualify for SIV status, the State Department is moving out in negotiation with the Taliban about 150 per week, which sounds like a lot when they brag about it, but that would take 140 years to get everybody out. So that's not a lot. And so, it's a catastrophe. We chose to stay and we worked with a coalition of several other nonprofits and that we led that effort there in Mazar Sharif and got another 5,000 people out over 2 months. And so that's where the 17,000 come from. And then we did that. We went into Tajikistan and did a river operation to help women and children be able to get out as well.
What do you think life is like now for the Afghan people now that the Taliban is taking control again?
Well, it's complete hell. Cause first of all, on two fronts, one, they have the terrorism of the Taliban. So, and then secondly, you have, a group of people who do not know how to govern. They're not a governing organization, clearly. And so the first part of terrorism side, I mean, just look at women, right? It's 20 million women there who are immediately sexually enslaved for the rest of their lives. They went from having more by ratio of women in their government than we have in the United States. They were teachers, they were doctors, they were dentists, they were journalists. All these women some of these women had never even seen the Taliban before. They were born after or even grew up post 9/11. So they just, all they knew was freedom. These women now can't even leave their home without a male escort. And even if they leave with a male escort, they're going to be pulled aside, investigated. They can't show any skin. They have to have a reason to be out of their house. So they're pretty much enslaved in homes. If they're single, or married to, or have been married to someone who's associated with the United States, they will be either raped and killed or sexually enslaved. We know for a fact that even little girls as young as 9 years old right now are being sold already into 50-year-old men in the sexual enslavement. We know that women do not have any kind of human rights at all, especially medical care. Just last month, they were told that they can no longer see male doctors. They're not allowed to be doctors or be educated to be doctors. So there's essentially no women's health care in Afghanistan. And because they, so that level of terrorism, there's a level of terrorism of pushing the Taliban ideologies, which is very inconsistent from province to province. So they're pushing those ideologies. If people don't subscribe to those ideologies, they'll be, you know, physically tortured, arrested, jailed, or killed for not conforming to those. Any Christians or, you know, Buddhist or Jewish, they're going to be, you know, killed for their faith. And then converter killed. And then they have the governing side. I mean, the Taliban is not a governing organization. They're a bunch of, you know, cavemen and, you know, who have been trained by Pakistan ISI and taught military style. But they're, if beyond cavemen, at best, they're a militant force, but they're not a governing agency that could run a country. So because of that, you're seeing starvation, people dying from food, from hunger and cold and medical care. And so, you know, the Afghan people, the 40 million people of Afghanistan are suffering right now. And it is a, you know, humanitarian crisis on top of, you know, on top of all of that, you have, again, the most strategic place in the globe between Iraq and Iran, Russia and China, that has been given to the Taliban, which ultimately has been given to China and Iran. China has the mineral rights to the Hindu Kush Mountains now, trillions of dollars of lithium. That's why they wanted us out of there. They also are able to get sanctioned oil from Iran, which is another reason they wanted us out of Afghanistan. And so China benefits the most economically, Iran militarily, and then Pakistan, you know, Pakistan ISI has always wanted, you know, that place strategically as well. And so the Taliban's really, to me, is a front to say, hey, the Taliban has this, but they're not the real players. They're just you know, kind of put out front. And the Doha agreement is a joke. You know?
So for people listening to you describe, one, what it took to go in and help get thousands of people out, the realization that there are still thousands of people there and the conditions that they're living in. If people hear that or they're watching this and they actually want to do something, where would you point them? Like, how can people, if they hear this and they are called to do something about it, where would you point people?
So, I mean, there's two sides. One, one of the things that I think was amazing that that we really seen was when the governments of the world don't do the right thing, including our own, especially our own, people will stand up and do the right thing. And American people did. What we did at Mighty Oaks Foundation, we did at Save Our Allies, was not 12 guys on the ground doing some cool stuff. Like, you know, it ended with me and Dennis Price going into Tajikistan and swimming across the river every night for 10 days, like helping get people out. And like, that sounds like great stuff, but I will say, like, 100% like certainty, we would never have been able to do any of that if it wasn't for the wave of American people that just said, this is wrong. We need to stand up and do the right thing. And if our government won't, we will. We were able to build an effort within days, and people came behind us financially. They came behind us with their voices on social media. They got behind us. The Christian community got behind us in prayer. People who hated me politically, because they follow me on social media and say, I don't like what you represent, but I love what you're doing right now. Where can I donate? We had a Jewish organization who wanted to donate $1.5 million, and they were going to make the donation through Mighty Oaks Foundation, and they realized we're a Christian organization. So they called me up and said, hey, we can't make the donation. And I thought maybe I gave them the routing number wrong. And they were like, no, you're a Christian organization. We're Jews. Like, we can't give you a Christian organization $1.5 million. So I'm like, okay, that's fine. But you do realize we're rescuing Muslims, right? And we like laughed, and they made the donation anyway. So it's so amazing to see that people could come together from all different backgrounds and just do the right thing. And I think that's important for people to know, because when we feel like we're helpless and we can't do nothing because our government's messing up, man, look what happened. Look what we proved we could do just as patriots and people of faith and people of conviction and people of principle. We just came together and did the right thing. And so that should give us a little bit of hope. And that should give you a kind of a understanding that NGOs, non-government organizations, nonprofits have the ability to actually really make an impact. So I'm not saying, you know, donate to Mighty Oaks Foundation or Save Our Allies, like pick where you want to do. But if you have a cause that's burdening your heart to do something important, and you don't feel like a government's doing it, that's why they have NGOs, non-government organizations. Make a donation, get behind it, support, see if they need volunteer help, get involved, take action. Don't just sit back as a spectator, because this world isn't a spectator sport. I mean, you gotta jump in sometimes, get your hands dirty and participate at whatever level you can. Sometimes, you know, all you can do is donate, and that's great. We need money to do the things we do. But the other area I think people really need to chip in is understanding the government side, the political side. I think in both political parties right now, Republican and Democrat, the constituents have really just conceded to the fact that these people are somehow like hierarchy or some kind of like hold some kind of status over us. And, you know, this isn't the role. These people in Congress, they're not the royal family. They are public servants that we elect in. And I think we can never forget that. We need to constantly remind them of that. Like us as constituents need to be holding them accountable for the decisions they make, the way they vote, and calling them and expressing a heart to them. Like, hey, this is what I want. This is what I want as a constituent. You're my representative in Congress, because that's what they are. Like if you're everyday American is a constituent to a congressman that represents you at the House at on Capitol Hill at Congress, and you need to be calling them, burning them up with emails and saying, this is wrong. This isn't right. This isn't what I elected you to do. And voicing those things. I mean, everybody right now, there's hearings going on for the Afghan evacuations. Anybody, any American citizen could give a SFR statement for the record. You could write your congressman and say, here's my statement for the record. You could write the House committee and say, here's my statement for the record. This is what I experienced. This is my view on this. And let our government know that we're not okay with what happened. And I think somehow over the last few years of this just political craziness we've been in, we feel like we have taken a backseat and we can't do anything, that the all is lost, and that, you know, we're you know, Washington D.C. somehow superior to us as patriots and citizens, and that's just not the case. And we have to remind them of that, and we remind them with our voices, and we call them up and we send them emails, and we say, as a constituent, this is what I believe, and I need you to represent me in this.
Yeah, you got to stay involved. I think that the people in those positions of power rely on, oftentimes, and this is just purely my opinion, but oftentimes rely on people feeling like there's nothing that they can do. They want them to feel overwhelmed, as if they can't make change, because that keeps those people in power and they can continue to do what they want to do.
100%. Yeah. And with the Afghanistan thing, I know you promoted it before, my book, Saving Aziz. It's kind of like a chronological series of events of what happened. And the Pentagon had it for like 5 months and they redacted a lot of stuff. But what's good about that is, you know, what's left in it is probably true. And so if you read that book and you find things, if you want a chronological series of events, what happened, you can read that book and say, hey, I don't like this. And it gives you some talking points to write to your congressman. But yeah, you're right. I think they just really want us to feel that we're, you know, we don't have any power anymore, but we do. And use your voices. Everybody has social media now. Use your voices. Don't be scared of the censorship. Push through it. I mean, my book, I was getting like, what, 12 million. And me and Mike Glover are both talking about this because he gets hit hard. I was getting 12 million engagements a month before the book, and it pushed it down like 500,000 the book after my book came out.
I'm sure that's random.
Yeah, I'm sure very random. 11, lost 11 and a half million. Yeah.
So I want to be respectful of your time. Where can people find out more about you and what it is that you have going on?
Best way to stay in touch, follow me. What I'm doing is my Instagram. That's where I stay most active. But I have a website, chadrobichaud.com. My foundation is mightyoakprograms.org. So if anybody wants to support what we do for active duty service members, veterans, and first responders, as well as our international efforts that we do at Mighty Oaks International, you could support there at mightyoakprograms.org. You could also, if you're a veteran, a first responder, military, spouse, we do about $7 million a year in free programming that we have tremendous resources to you. And we have some incredible help for PTSD, anxiety, depression, divorce, like all those things. So definitely hit us up on our website. We'll be able to help out.
Hope you enjoyed the episode today. To learn more about how you can help in evacuations from Afghanistan and provide aid to vulnerable communities, check out saveourallies.org. Normal spelling on all of that. Saveourallies.org. Also, please check out Chad's book, Saving Aziz. It is available now anywhere that you can find your preferred literature.